Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here at this workshop, and Chris invited me to talk about museums. So museums are obviously one way in which the public interact with paleontology. I'd say it used to be that that was the main way that people would, you know, the general public, if such a thing exists, experience paleontologists at museums. Today, I'd say there's much more exposure, perhaps through news articles, blog posts, etc. But museums are kind of the ones which are the least transient. So they're the ones which are there for the longest period of time, and the ones that people, most people, say if you think about school children, and we kind of say museums that we get people when they're children, and then we get people when they have children. So most people don't visit museums a huge amount. So the other 97% is kind of making the most of underwhelming fossils in museums, but also the other 90% of kind of paleontological knowledge. And many of you may recognize this very famous image by an up-and-coming paleo artist of is it interesting to us? Not yet. So this is a kind of a composite of less interesting fossils who have got together to try and make themselves look like something more interesting. But of course, their fatal error is they've gone for a Stegosaurus, which is kind of the D-list of interesting dinosaurs at best. So thinking about museums, obviously there are permanent displays and then there are exhibitions. And paleontologically, the exhibitions, mostly from the larger museums because they can afford it, are often on kind of six different themes. So sometimes you have kind of the Ice Age fauna, mostly includes mammoths, maybe woolly rhino. This is me and colleagues enjoying ourselves at the recent Natural History exhibition. So that's one kind, as you'll hear about Ice Age fauna, probably mammoths. Then you've got dinosaurs, of course, and then you've got dinosaurs, and then you have dinosaurs again, and you have dinosaurs again. So these are all recent examples of the Natural History Museum in London's touring exhibitions. So these are pretty much all the paleontologically themed touring exhibitions. And then occasionally you get some of this nonsense, and it kind of sets, you know, nobody goes to these human evolution exhibitions, and so they cycle back around to Ice Age mammals and dinosaurs. So this is kind of what people are being exposed to, and I think we're trapped, museums are trapped in a cycle of kind of reusing this content, because really paleontology, when it comes to paleontology, natural history, dinosaurs in general have become synonymous with not just natural history museums, but museums in general. So I talked to colleagues in other museums, and particularly people who work for kind of visitor services, be it at the V&A or the British Museum or the Science Museum, one of their number one questions is, where are the dinosaurs? So people just think it's a museum, there must be dinosaurs, they want to go and see them. But of course it's a cycle, so people only want to come and see the dinosaurs, but of course when most of our exciting new content is dinosaurs, they're not really going to expect anything else. And of course the other problem with museums is their time scales. So by the time, unlike perhaps art museums, where their exhibitions are genuinely updating the scholarship. So the catalogue that goes along with it will be updating whatever Rembrandt attributions or whatever the theme is. In natural history museums, it's not really updating the scholarship. So you know, papers will be written, and then by the time a museum gets together with putting together an exhibition touring programme, buying in some animatronics or new specimens, those kind of interesting findings are no longer interesting, no longer relevant, have been solved, and that's why we end up with some content which is kind of around non-traverses. So, you know, by the time these exhibitions are coming out, it's really quite behind the current science. Despite all this, museums are still trusted authorities. So despite all we do to kind of undermine this, they are still trusted authorities, and around the time that we were all groaning, audibly groaning, this article came out, which I think most people read, where somebody said, okay, all these paleontologists, including people in this room, whinging about Jurassic World, let's go and have a look at the Natural History Museum and spot the inaccuracies. And of course, as we all know, there are many, as there are in museums across the world. So we're still trusted authorities, people still come to us, even though we're quite behind, can be inaccurate, and we like to use the well-worn path. So these kind of easy go-to phrases that aren't particularly scientifically accurate and don't necessarily mean anything. So this is museums talking about missing links still, living fossils still. So these really easy phrases that, you know, if you're talking about the Nautilus, or if you're talking about some other kind of thing that's described as a living fossil, can't think of a single organism at the moment, then it's easy to say these are living fossils, despite the fact that most people don't know what the phrase living fossils means, and living fossils doesn't mean what we think it means. So it's a nonsense concept. We should just say nothing rather than say it's a missing link or a living fossil. It's already been mentioned, we also have people like Mary Bloody Anning, I've called her here. So, you know, the most biographied, promoted, researched forgotten scientist there ever was. There are many more other forgotten scientists, there are many more other forgotten female scientists, yet through the media, through museums, we still keep talking about these same old characters, and the same goes for Alfred Russel Wallace and other people like that. And really, museums kind of have a low standing across the science sector. So there's this report called Geology for Society, published by the Geological Society, and the word museums does not enter this at all, neither does outreach, neither does fossil festivals, neither does all that stuff that Chris was talking about. So it's not seen, as we're not seeing as having an impact in Geology for Society, despite the fact that most of us would kind of say the reason we got into this was because of something we saw at a museum, or a fossil festival, or a fossil hunting trip. So it's not because geoengineering is important to water quality, or, you know, rare and precious metals and minerals. So museums don't really kind of, they're not even coming onto the agenda of people who think would be saying this is a huge area of geology for society. Directly linked there, we're talking to people, it's cultural. So I mentioned earlier the problem with kind of dinosaurs being the main output and becoming synonymous with a natural history museum. And so this question will be perhaps the second most common question that people ask in a natural history museum. Naturalist museum, particularly children. So the first one is it real, always? And the next one is it a dinosaur? And anything that is in a naturalist museum, especially if it's an articulated skeleton, is automatically a dinosaur, particularly for younger people. And you know, when you listen to museum visitors, their children will say, is it a dinosaur? And the parents will go, yeah, you know, nodding at a camel, a horse, a giraffe, whatever it is. Because it's a skeleton, it's a dinosaur, museums are synonymous with them. Of course, if you think about museum collections, if you think about paleontological knowledge in general, dinosaurs is just one part of it. So what about the other 97%? Well, it's realistically more the other 99%. So this is the collections that we have. So as you all know, it's less than 1% of collections are normally on display. It's not the stuff that's made up, makes up most of the museum collections. And the normal line for museums is that this stuff is for researchers, behind the scenes research. But actually, for those of us who work in museums, we know that actually vast swathes of the paleontological collections don't receive visitors. So we rarely receive mollusk visitors, we rarely receive people to have a look at the graphite collections. So what can we do about this kind of other 99% of knowledge and specimens, which tend to look a bit like this? Actually, this one's quite a nice example. Well, the way it's done in kind of public displays are displays like this, right, inspiring nobody since the 19th century. And you see these displays in museums all over the world. So you'll probably recognise some of these. We've got the Naturalist Museum, British Fossils Gallery. We've got the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, kind of thematic displays around the wall. This is the National Museum in Prague, and that's the Taylor Museum down the bottom there. So just this kind of stuff that's put in a case, bare interpretation, maybe something about the kind of different periods that we're going through, maybe arranged taxonomically, maybe you've just got the kind of scientific name that's probably wrong or out of date. And we just seem to be stuck into this kind of 19th century mode of displaying the rest of paleontology. And if you think this is kind of an old practice or just displays you haven't got around to updating, this is a very cherry-picked bit of the Natural History Museum's collaboration with the Google Cultural Institute that was kind of launched yesterday, I think. And so this is how an element of their digitized collections are presented. So you can see almost exactly the same as these. This top one here, I don't imagine anybody who will start a lifelong collaboration or a lifelong passion for paleontology from that one single specimen there. So we really struggle to do anything interesting with things which aren't kind of obvious or things that we haven't done over and over again. So I'm going to talk a little bit about something that I did in my museum career to kind of change that. So when I was at the Grant Museum of Zoology at UCL, we had a huge collection of fossil fish, semi-important, and it was associated with people like DMS Watson, but in reality nobody had really come, apart from one research group that had come to look at 8 fossils in the 10 years that I was there. Nobody had come to see this collection. So what do we do with this kind of collection? How do we interpret it? We can't make it interesting in that obvious way. You know, these Hoplopteryx is not doing particularly interesting things for us to talk about. So we started this blog series for Grant Museum called Underwhelming Fossil Fish of the Month. And the aim was, basically, all I was attempting to do is to give these dull fossils a bit of time, encourage people to kind of think about them, maybe tell a friend about them, and together we'll increase the global fish literacy, one fossil fish at a time. So the idea was, you know, and it was a little bit naughty, was to, instead of the usual museum line saying these are all fantastic, wonderful things, everything you have in the collection is amazing, perfect, and perfectly documented, was to try and highlight some of these collections which just aren't. So kind of ask the question, why do we have this? Thank you. Why do we have this? What's the history of it? When was it last looked at? So very broadly, quite easy, any drawer you open, find a boring fossil fish, and basically start from the top left and keep working through every month. And kind of had a breakdown of the specimen history, so where does it come from? 9 times out of 10, we don't know, or from Asia, or something like that. The preservation, comment on the preservation of it, the scientific research into the species and the specimen, and then the wider cultural impact on society. Most of these things, it's nice, that's where you have to make some stuff up. And it wasn't just a kind of very dry presentation of these things, it was spiced up with kind of nonsense, really, but in a way to try and keep people reading and looking. So we had a find fossil section, so this is how the underwater fossil fish a month, which grid is the actual fossil supposed to be in. We've got some dodgy payoffs, and then you know, kind of tying into whatever we remade films around these fossil fishes because they were slightly nicely preserved, and then even kind of taxonomic choose your own adventures for names where basically nobody really bothered to correct the names in the 19th century. So some of this, as well as the scientific content, and that was seemed to be a really, really good thing. So it took a couple of hours a month to write those, and so it led to kind of lots of other things. So it led to a live show, so there's a small set about underwhelming fossil fish. Various kind of media organizations got in touch to focus on these boring fossil fish, and that was great, so that was Motherboard, I think. Museum Practice got in touch, so lots of that kind of, how do you make boring collections exciting? So I got quite a few bits of interest there. And eventually ended up talking about fossil fish on Radio 4 Inside Science, a paper for Paleontological Association, and then other museums like here, kind of underwater fossil fish would pop up. So taking initially a collection which is useless, unusable, don't worry about it, don't worry about documenting it, to something that the museum was then known for, and an interest, albeit an interest in how uninteresting some of these things are. And I'm very happy to report that this summer we just wrapped up filming this film, Fishery, the Untold Story of the Stockholm School, about the Stockholm School of Fish Paleontologists in Scandinavia and their exciting contributions to fossil fish paleontology. Of course, this never happened, but it's on the cards. So thinking about this, and of course this is one approach, we can't all be doing underwhelming fossils in the collection, but just by thinking a little bit creatively, changing slightly how we talk about paleontology, it kind of opens up interest, and so we get out of this cycle that we're stuck in. And we've got such a wealth of kind of tools and technology to enable that. So it's not necessarily just through exhibitions. We've got the podcasts, we've got 3D printing, etc., etc. Occasionally, we kind of do break our own rules. So when the Tully monster research came out last year, that was one example where, as all the science writers, we just decided to ignore the traditional rules about what's interesting or not. And so, this story was reported by news agencies and museums all over the place. Again, it's quite, it is interesting. And it's like, okay, well, when are we going to see these kind of things in displays, in exhibitions? You should try and make sure that stuff like this isn't just that transitory. I don't think anybody now out there knows what Tully Monster is, but for those couple of hours during that week, everyone was thinking about, or exposed to Tully Monster in any case. So how can we translate these kind of things more and more into museum practice and get away from the kind of usual the usual things. Think about impact in museums, and this one's really important. So actually, we're kind of a weird group of people in this room because very few people go to museums regularly. So most people may go to a naturalist museum maybe once a year. They probably won't go to more than one naturalist museum a year. They probably won't be like us, who probably spend half our time in museums, visiting museums or talking about museums. And it's very interesting because we don't get this kind of feedback. So this is feedback on some Guardian articles. So despite the fact we're told not to read the comments, sometimes you do, or sometimes your family send them to you and say, this person is very rude. Because you've got this huge audience, people, the hits go from like 100,000 down to perhaps 5,000, 10,000. And you get this massive scope between people who think or may well know it all and cannot empathise with perhaps other people not knowing everything that they know, through to people saying, this fossil from here, I wasn't aware of octopuses or mollusks. This was a great article.
There's someone here on the ringer, it's not very nice, not very friendly. Just one of them saying, this is great, but I didn't know that octopuses were mollusks. It's really, really hard. We've got a huge, huge range generally to try and address, and how can we address that through some of the stuff we'll be talking about later. Thank you. One thing in general with the way that we do exhibitions interpretation in museums is we're really, really still using this 1850 model of communicating paleontology, going all the way back to the Crystal Palace dinosaurs. So, okay, we might have a bit more of an earlier section talking about Ediacara, and we might have a bit of a later section talking about human evolution, but in general, we tend to talk about this narrative. It's always a progression up towards humans, and we only ever talk about the most interesting animals that are around at that time. So as soon as other things come along, we stop talking about whatever, ammonites and fish, because more interesting things like tetrapods are around, and then dinosaurs turn up, so we stop talking about all other kinds of animals. And we still, even in things like textbooks, even how we visualize, again, this is from the US literature, the same old stories, progression, very much telling our evolutionary history, not necessarily the evolutionary history of life, which is quite limiting. The other thing is creativity. So, in general, I would just like a lot more creativity. And it seems to be something that we were hugely creative in the 19th century. I think it's because we had a bit more resource, a bit more vested interest in it, and also there's much higher status being associated with the museum. So the leading scientists would have been at the museum, whereas today that's not necessarily the case. There are still some great colleagues in museums. And so that's how we still end up with, I still see them, but I couldn't find an image that I could use. We still find tree-licking giant sloths. And that goes right the way back to, you know, when their first description, their first recovery. We see it here in the Starlux plastic models, we see it in the Naturalist Museum. The full slide of this, without kind of crediting worries, is just a wall of tree-licking sloths. So we're kind of stuck in this mode. And we're stuck with the 19th century examples that we use. We don't really talk about anything new. So where are, you know, the kind of interactive Diplograpsus things on galleries? Where's the kind of dioramas of Climacoceras rutting or whatever? Or, you know, solute play sets, or, you know, Camaraceras dress up for children, or whatever it may be. Or Leeds Ichthys scale models. We don't have any of this at all. We fit into these really, really conservative same things over there. One new development in the way we try and interpret collections is this very successful history of the blah in however many blahs. So history of the world, and this really kind of has been hugely popular. Kind of was really popularized by the British Museum's approach to the history of the world, 100 objects, and now there are hundreds and hundreds of these. And it really speaks to kind of the listicle and the kind of short attention span, coffee book kind of thing. You're not really gonna learn anything by just picking these things up. But this seems to be an easy, marketable, attention span capturing things. We're seeing this a lot more in museum output. Again, this is fresh from the Naturalist Museum Google Cultural Institute collaboration. And occasionally there are museums doing some interesting things with it. So this is from the Royal Belgian Institute in, Royal National Institute in Belgium. And there's this very small selection in the paleontological galleries of speculative evolution. So this is an animal that does not yet exist. And they had, I think they had some kind of crazy flying lemurs. And that was really, really interesting, but very subtle. So it's just kind of alongside the fossils. So again, people were going around saying, oh, look at that interesting animal, not realizing that it was completely made up theoretical animal. Because you have to read the labels, and nobody reads the labels. Through to some of this stuff from my museum. So, you know, oh, a nice Dictyodon. And I know that they do get these every now and then. But seeing a nice reconstructed one, or think about Schrödinger, think about Conchester. So a little bit more of this, a little bit more creativity, and kind of breaking the mold and really getting away from these 19th century stereotypes. And we'll be hearing a lot over the next 2 days about where we can be inspired by this. If paleo art, for example, at the moment, is just so creative and interesting, so how can we translate those into museums? How can we scare the pants off of children so they never forget Tanistrophius rather than, you know, sad old animatronics of dinosaurs? And one last thing, for anyone watching out there, we definitely need more angry cephalopods in our galleries. For the very least, so thank you very much.